I wanted to build a company that will be around in 50, maybe 100 years.
Hey everyone, welcome to Shopify Masters in studio here in Los Angeles. I'm Serena Smith. What if one of the world's most popular celebrity chefs discovered your product on Instagram and liked it so much he became your business partner? That is exactly what happened with Hexclad.
We were like, we solved that. So I knew that we had something special.
That is just one chapter in a much bigger story. Today, we're talking to Danny Weiner, co-founder and CEO of Hexclad.
You got to lead by example. You got to be willing to do anything. And you got to be willing to stay a little longer, work a little harder.
The cookware company bet early on direct-to-consumer, disrupted a sleepy industry with real innovation, and became a global brand topping more than $380 million in revenue. Welcome to the show, Danny.
Thank you so much for having me, Serena.
What does it conjure in you when you hear that your company is doing $380 million in revenue?
Well, that sounds like last year's numbers, but...
Update us.
Well, it's a bit surreal. The weird timing of what happened with Hexclad was rather unique because it was like this perfect storm of having a great product, which we do, D2C becoming a way people were really starting to embrace as a shopping platform. And then when the pandemic hit, being forced that people, if you wanted to shop, that's where you had to buy stuff. And in our space, everybody's home cooking. Sometimes some people for the first time in their lives that they're now turning themselves into a home chef. So we were so buried deep into trying to fulfill orders and run this new business that we didn't realize really the impact. And that I was shocked the first time somebody told me, I was on an airplane. They're like, oh, I know Hexclad. And I'm like, you do? Wow. It was surprising. Yeah.
When you have your head down like that, and you're just trying to put one foot in front of the other. And as a founder also, right, you're so often in a state of pretty constant stress and anxiety. What were those moments for you? Like, oh, I'm kind of arriving somewhere, you know?
There's several moments of that. Because you go through this stage when you're starting the company where you wake up panicked at 4 a.m. Mm-hmm. And you're not even sure what you should be doing at 4 a.m., but you're like, I better get up and work. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to be working because then at least I know I'm putting in 100% towards my goal. So then I don't have to like somehow in the back of my mind beat myself up that I'm not doing everything. Mm-hmm. But then when you get this positive feedback from the consumer, it's really, really quite gratifying. But to me, like the most exciting moment we've had as a company was when the first time I started hiring people, mm-hmm. when it went from my co-founder and I, Cole, doing everything, wearing every hat, to providing jobs for people. I get excited when we're starting a new employee. I always make sure I go up and find out about them, you know, make sure I, you know their name, where they live, et cetera. And that still brings me the greatest joy.
I think there's something so interesting about that process of bringing other people in, because on the one hand, it's like, oh, great, like I get to not wear 67 hats and I can deputize people who maybe have skill sets that are even more developed than mine, you know, bring smarter people into the equation to fill in my gaps. But sometimes there can also be a little bit of difficulty in terms of letting go of the reins when it's your baby.
It's still a challenge. You know, it's a little bit like, I've never had to send a kid off to college, but there is this like, oh, how are they going to survive without me? And if you're a good CEO, I want to be the dumbest guy in the room. And my ego doesn't want to be, but if I've done a great job, I will be the dummy in the room. And I'm fine with that ultimately, because the fact is the company is what's important. The company is what pays all our employees. The company is what produces this amazing product for the public. So the healthier it is, the more successful it is, everybody wins then.
How do you approach the hiring process and building a team to ensure that you're bringing the right people in and that they can also like continue to carry your vision forward?
I'll be frank, now like people reach out for jobs all the time because, you know, we have been so successful the last few years. I think we have a good reputation of being a great place to work, and we respect people's talent, their career aspirations, but also like I respect their lives. Like I walk through the office at 5:30 and I'm like, get out of here. I yell at everybody, go home, because I want them to go home and spend time with their families. Yes, I want you to work really, really hard, but I only want you to do it for 8 hours. Then mm-hmm. I want you to go home and live your life. We were competing for talent in 19, 20. Now really good talent's coming to us. And then we have the benefit of going, do they fit who we are? Because culturally, I want to create an environment where the employee is nurtured both professionally and personally. And we have fun together, like we do company happy hours, we do these company lunches, and like every single person's at the cool kids table at lunch, and we just laugh. And I love when people aren't talking about frying pans then. I like when they're talking about each other's kids or vacations they have coming up, because I think like then people don't want to leave. And that is the thing I'm most proud of. I can count on both hands, so less than 10 people that have either been fired or have quit our company since 2016.
Wow. Are there like actual character traits that you would point to in terms of any advice for the business owners out there in terms of what it means to be a good leader and to be able to sort of inspire that enthusiasm and galvanize your team?
You as a leader, and it doesn't mean just the founder. Like some people will throw that in my face, because I'll do stuff like people will see me and I'll be in like the men's room and I'll be cleaning the men's room because it's dirty. And I know that somebody's going to do it eventually, but I'm not above cleaning the men's room. I wash the dishes if people left coffee mugs in the sink because they're dirty and somebody's got to do it. And maybe if they see me do it, somebody else will do it. You got to be able to roll up your sleeves. Like I've had people, a high-level executive for us, and we did an event, and I saw one of our junior people she had to break down like 100 boxes from all the product we'd sent for the event. So I went in and I'm like, she goes, oh, no, you don't come. You don't have to do that. I'm like, let's get out of here. Let's do it. And I had somebody senior and I'm watching this person like, you know, stand over there. And I go, will you get over here, grab a fucking knife and cut these boxes down? What are you know, we're going to be here forever.
Yeah.
And it was like an aha moment for them. And it kind of registered. And we joke about it now. You know, we'll talk about the boxes. I'm like, come on, there's boxes to be done. But that's it. Like, you got to be lead by example. You got to be willing to do anything. And you got to be willing to stay a little longer, work a little harder. And if you do that, then that just trickles down. So it's really important that you lead by example.
You've spoken a lot in the past about the failures that preceded HexClad and its massive success. Can you talk a little bit about how those failures have actually set you up for being able to be in a state of continued consistent success today?
Yeah, yes. I would say this, even if it's like something in your youth, you know, when you fail, whether it, you know, you're playing in the Little League championship game, you lose. I remember the bitterness of that. And one of two things is going to happen, right, when you fail. You're going to just like kind of sulk and go, well, wasn't my time. Or you're going to be like, you know, God damn it, what can I do to be a little better the next opportunity that I get? And whether it's like as a little kid playing sports or whether it's, you know, a test you take in school or in college, but when you start businesses, it's okay to fail. It's how you react to that failure. And how do you look at it and then go, what is truly my role in this failure? I've said this to my team before. I'm like, people look for the reasons we weren't successful or something underperformed. Somebody will scour the room looking for the answer. And the last place they look is in the mirror. And the fact is that very often we don't want to admit the role we played in a failure. And when Cole and I started the company, our first product failed. I've talked about it. It was a good product. And it was, we misjudged the market. It was a cold press juicer. And it was at the beginning of the juicing craze. And stupidly, we never thought that, oh, people love juice. They're going to start opening shops all over the place. And I knew when I heard Whole Foods was opening a juice shop in every store. And I went to New York and I saw every corner market had a juice shop. And I'm like, you know, this is just a matter of time. And that was the hardest decision I ever had to make, was like 5 p.m. on a Tuesday. We were in the juicer business. And 9 a.m. the next morning, we were not in the juicer business. Like, I had to shut my baby down, you know, at that time. Now, after it was over, once the cookware started getting successful, like, all of these people who I trust was like, oh, I always hated that juicer idea. And I'm like, well, why didn't you say anything?
Where was the honesty?
Yeah. And they're like, you know, you didn't ask for any hard, you know, criticism or advice on this. And I may have had a difficult conversation with you then. And then I said, you know what? That's something I got to learn. I got to go to people and tell them the truth. Because you might have a shitty idea and you need some tough love. Or you have an opportunity to sell them on that idea. And if you do it properly, you're learning how you're going to sell the public that idea mm-hmm. and why you're going to make their life better with whatever widget that you're bringing to market.
It's a paradigm shift, really. It feels like you're talking about the distinction between like a fixed mindset and a growth mindset, you know? If you can look at everything as an opportunity to grow and learn, you're going to be setting yourself up on the path for success, regardless of what you're doing.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And the key thing right there, it's like looking at everything, even a challenge, as an opportunity. Mm-hmm. It's an opportunity to get better. I remember trying to fine-tune the messaging with HexClad. You know, in the beginning, it wasn't resonating. Like, everybody laughed at me when I went to try to raise money and say, we're going to be a D2C cookware company. Nobody had ever done that yet. So in 15 and 16, like, you know, we were still fine-tuning the product at that point. And I kept getting kind of beat up and kicked to the curb out of these rooms as I met bankers and, you know, nobody, they're like, oh, cookware's too competitive. I'm like, this is different. This is finally an innovation. There's been no innovation since Teflon came out in 1959. And then they're like, well, how are you going to get shelf space? I'm like, I don't want shelf space because we're going to be the first D2C cookware brand. And they're like, nobody buys cookware that way. Thanks for, you know, thanks for stopping by. Take a water on your way out, you know? But I kept looking at those as opportunities. And eventually I was able to take the learnings in those rooms and turn those into some good Facebook ads. And like, what wasn't resonating with people, you know, but it was probably best that that didn't happen because we had to be scrappy. We had to be scrappy until the pandemic was happening.
Yeah, it's like so hard in the moment, but in retrospect, you look back and you go, oh, it all happened as it was meant to. And thank God, you know, but in the moment you're like, oh, another no. How many no's did you get?
You know, I don't remember because they're like, it's hurtful because you know, the cookware is my baby and you're going in and somebody's telling me your baby's ugly. And
no, it sucks.
Yeah. So like, yes, you try to learn from it. And then I try to forget about those people. Like I did run into somebody that their family office was looking for some investments. They'd sold a product and they made a ton of money. And the son was just like very condescending and like almost like I'd wasted their time. And I ran into the guy like maybe a year and a half ago. And I was just like, I guess you missed that one, didn't you? You know?
How did he respond?
He kind of laughed and, you know, and that was it. You know, like they knew, they invest in bad things. They miss great opportunities, but they also hit some home runs too. Mm-hmm. So he got it.
But, you know, there's no price for decency.
Yeah. You know, the thing is people are risking livelihoods. They're risking their future in a way. We need human decency. It's like, I appreciate when people are taking risks and the more willingness they are to let me ask hard questions of them, I think they'll benefit from it. And not just me, anyone, but I always handle it in a way that respects the fact that they're taking a chance and not everybody does that. And it should be applauded.
Yeah. It's insanely courageous.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of ways to be courageous in life, but it's very particular to put yourself out there in this way.
It absolutely is. And you know, the thing is, I didn't become successful till later on. And here's the thing. It's almost like when, you know, a 24-year-old tries to raise money from friends and family, does something, loses their money, and he's applauded for taking a chance. And he might be successful in the next one or the next one. Mm-hmm. When a 52-year-old takes a risk, they go like, what a dummy. What, you know, what's he thinking? He's got kids.
Yeah.
You know, he's past his prime. And the fact is, I think it should all be applauded because it doesn't matter how old you are. A good idea is a good idea. And we shouldn't make somebody feel foolish or irresponsible for taking a chance. I'm not saying like spend your kids' college tuition money on it, but you know, we should no longer say one is acceptable and one isn't.
Well, and I think also there's another thing that it feels like you're pointing toward, which is that there's so much value placed on like making it young, having your success at a young age, making your money young. But I do think that there's also an argument to be made that there's like great value and utility in hitting it a little bit later on in life. You've built character, you have life experience, you've built more resilience, right? Like what are the things that you feel like, you know, in your 50s actually set you up better?
You know, this might be the most important question that you're asking for a lot of young viewers or listeners. Because when I was a kid, it was like, I was so happy to just like be able to sit at the table while my uncles played cards. You weren't supposed to talk, you know. I'm not saying I'm smarter than a 25-year-old, but I'm guaranteeing I'm wiser. And you can learn from my wisdom, because all the mistakes you're going to make from 25 to 40, I made them. And if you listen to me, maybe you'll make one fewer mistakes. And that's really it. I love that the mix of having people of different ages working together, because I love that there's no way that I can manage our tech stack and know what everything does perfectly and how things integrate and how they're enhancing each other. But I got a super smart 27-year-old who's telling me how that happens. But on the other end, I know how to market across ages and create a compelling story that's going to make somebody want to enjoy our products. I can also develop a product. They can't do that yet. So we enhance each other. I believe that this life experience and wisdom is undervalued by many companies. And when I see companies failing and I see a 29-year-old CEO, you are not qualified to be a CEO. You're just not. Because you have to inspire, lead. You need to take all the failures of a lifetime to be able to run a company properly. Now, could you be 35? Could you be 40? Yeah, absolutely. I would always say that person, even if he's a founder, he should find a strong leader and learn from that person mm-hmm. so he's ready to take over. Take a guy who's 50 who wants to retire in the next 6-7 years, learn everything from him, and then you become like an even better CEO.
Oh my God, yeah. There's so much power in mentorship. And yep. also just a sort of humility and a willingness to say, like, I actually don't know, or I don't know enough, or I don't know everything. And yeah, it can be hard, because I think sometimes it's like, you know, you've got young, precocious, plucky, incredibly smart people who want to start something of their own. And it can be really difficult. It can feel, even if there's the internal desire to want to learn from somebody mm-hmm. who's older, wiser, knows better, I think there sometimes can be a fear that like it's going to reveal some kind of weakness, you know, that then will make them look like they're not fit to lead. It does feel like a sort of shift that has to happen, you know, that like it's okay. It's okay to ask for help.
Yeah, it's okay to ask questions. There's no stupid question, even when it is stupid. Now, if you got to ask the same thing 10 times to me, I'm going to get frustrated, but ask questions, ask for help. I am certainly not a finished product right now as
we
a CEO, as a person,
and
we shouldn't be, exactly. So if you're younger, again, look at everything as an opportunity, a learning opportunity to get better, to become a better manager, to become a better visionary, and to be, the most important thing, a better communicator.
You were talking about how some of those early no's from mm-hmm. investors turned into like growth opportunities and learning opportunities that you then were like able to parlay into Facebook ads. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what that trajectory was, what you were taking from those moments and how it served you?
Well, you know, sometimes you think, you look at a product having certain value props about it, right? And sometimes you can't see the forest through the trees, that what you think is like the key value prop really isn't. And I remember people upset that I go, we built this product so well for a frying pan, we're going to give it a lifetime warranty because we've tested it, it holds up. And they're like, that's terrible. We want to keep, you know, you want the iPhone, you want planned obsolescence,
yeah.
you know? And I'm like, well, that's not really what I want to do. What I want is like, I'll sell them one frying pan and they love it, so they'll buy a second frying pan and then they'll buy our knives. I remember what was key was one thing was being able to convince people that that strategy was better than trying to sell them the same frying pan over and over and over again. And ultimately what that came down to is, what's your long-term goal? I often say big picture, little picture stuff. And a lot of people want to focus on the little picture, but it doesn't always serve the big picture. So the big picture started as, what do you want to be? I want to be a legacy brand. I wanted to build a company that will be around in 50, maybe 100 years. I didn't want to build something, you know, burn through cash, just stimulate growth and try to exit. And there are cookware companies, I think that that's their strategy based on the quality of the product and the way that they handle it. They're always raising money. And so for us, I work backwards from that goal, which is, we're going to be with you on a journey for your lifetime. I didn't want to be Apple. I wanted to be Sony of 1985, where my dad didn't have to do any research. He just went to the store and he's like, where's the Sony stuff? Because they made great stuff. They really good warranties, really good customer service. That's what he wants. So like, I want people to go, oh, we don't need to, you know, read Wirecutter and read the review. We just know HexClad makes great stuff. Go to HexClad.com. Oh, they got a cutting board. I'm looking for a cutting board. Add to cart. And, you know, so that's really what I wanted.
And in a world where it's just like an endless onslaught of products and options being thrown at us, which, like, there's a great privilege around that also, you know, but it can be overwhelming. It's also like, as a consumer, what a relief to just say, oh, I can trust this. And then you come out with something new and you say, well, I can probably trust that also.
Yeah. And that's like, that's the way it should be. That's the way it used to be. Like, everything's coming around. Like, it does come full circle in a way. And I think it's great that consumers care about who they're buying from. And I really think we owe that to the younger millennials and Gen Z. Like, they care more about who they're buying from than maybe our parents did. Our parents, I want a deal. I want it on sale, my dad would say. I mean, he still tells me, he's like, oh, you know, I buy those little pods for the coffee. He goes, I can save 10 cents if I drive across town. I'm like, Dad.
You're spending more than that in gas.
Yeah, your gas. Yeah. But it's a different generation. So he doesn't really care about that stuff. He cares about the 10 cents. And that is important. But, you know, if you only save 5 cents, but you buy from somebody who has a personal and a brand ethos that aligns with yours as the consumer, then who do you want to buy from, right?
Can you tell me a little bit about the thought process in terms of the materials that go into your pans?
You know, what we've always strived to do is use the best possible ingredients, whether it's the steel, the quality of our Stay Cool handle, and including our Terrabond coating, which is the most durable coating of its type. It's a ceramic-based nonstick that actually lasts for years, which is why it's the first ceramic-based nonstick that we could give a lifetime warranty to. We spent almost 7 years developing it till it was good enough so people can be confident that it's safe. And more importantly, they can be confident that they're not going to be having to go to the store every year to buy the pan over and over and over again. Instead of 400 degrees of heat, it's safe up to 900 degrees, which you would never cook at. But the fact is, that means it's highly, highly unlikely you're going to damage it from overheat. We also wanted to make it free from forever chemicals. This is kind of a very, like, trendy subject right now about PFAS chemicals, and whether it's pans or clothing. You know, it's weird how we get caught on one thing, because a lot of cookware companies have gotten a lot of heat about using these without a lot of understanding, which is probably this furniture, the rugs, they all have PFAS. And actually, that's the way it's been explained to me by our engineers, is that's probably more likely to be ingested when you wash your clothes. If they have them on them, it gets into the water, gets into your water supply. You know, there's a lot of challenges there, but we always said, well, if we can make it better and give people comfort, let's do that. Now, I also don't want to beat you over the head with it. To be honest, when I read the science, you know, what the EPA and the FDA say about it, it seems like most of these coatings that people have been using since they were little kids are safe. I don't want to scare people. That's not my job. I just want to promote our product as a great product. So, like, the first thing doesn't have to be free from forever chemicals, because that's not important to everyone.
Right.
It is to a lot of people. I always want to promote value. and that like this is built to last. And I feel our product is highly sustainable. It's sustainable through durability, though. That's the best type. Like, you don't have to buy it over and over again.
Right.
So it's nice if it doesn't end up in a landfill.
Right, after a couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were talking about wanting to create a legacy brand, something that can really stand the test of time and people can have some faith in the quality of what they're buying, they can trust. With the genesis of Hexclad, like, were you looking to fill a hole in the market and you knew what that hole was? Or was it more happenstance that you found something and thought, wow, this is lightning in a bottle?
A little of both, probably more of the second. I had worked for a cookware company before we started Hexclad. In fact, actually, I didn't want to be in cookware anymore. That's why we started a juicer company. But I knew the pain points the consumer had because I'd done it for years. And as a frustrated maybe chef, like, I never wanted to work in a restaurant. It's so hard. Like, chefs have to be a little insane to put up with it. I'm a foodie. My grandmother was the first female head chef in Buffalo, New York in the 50s.
Oh my God, amazing.
And it's all my cousins are in the restaurant business. So I always loved it, but I didn't want to be behind the hot stove, unless I'm doing it for friends and family at my house.
It's like your hospitality, like, adjacent.
Yeah.
You're like close enough to really respect it, but you're like, I don't want to be in the kitchen for 14 hours. Thank you.
Exactly. And so what that gave me, though, was an interest to kind of be touching it. So I got to talk to chefs and work with them and eat great meals. But I did know what people complained about. So I always kept like my finger on the pulse of what was going on in the cookware market. And then I found the gentleman who invented this laser etching process with these hexagons. And his first product was a Korean barbecue plate. And they were selling it in Korea. And he had just started playing around with frying pans. I started talking to him. And it was just luck that I met him. And I'm like, we can make these so they'd sell in the Western market. And he's like, yeah, I played around. Let's work on it. And I don't know why he trusted me, because the juicer was doing okay at the time. I didn't have a lot of money. It's like when you're feeding, you know, the fire to drive growth a bit. So we're at that stage with the juicer. So I didn't have a lot of money. And he decided to trust me and not like try to sell this technology to anybody else in the US. And he didn't have the product ready yet. And we didn't have enough money to buy it yet. But I worked with him and I helped him make it a little more, say, consumer friendly for the US. And we got it done. And I'm like, we hit so many pain points, which were, I yell at my husband because he uses metal spatulas, or I hate that they can't go in the dishwasher, or it doesn't go in the oven. One thing that like I was really high on doing was like, we put our design and our ceramic coating on the outside of the pan, because one of the things I always knew people bitched about was the outside of their pans getting burnt oil marks on them. And so we were like, we solved that. So I knew that we had something special.
You were sort of in the midst of the juice company for part of this, but at a certain point you put that to bed and you're coming off of that failure.
Yeah.
And you're trying to build something new and you're going into rooms and you're getting no's. I think there's a question that can come up in founders' minds and moments, and you sort of spoke to it in the beginning of the interview, where it's like, am I right to believe in this or am I delusional? You know, and was there a dark night of the soul in the process of Hexclad, or had you built up so much resilience at that point that you just knew that this was the thing?
I knew, because I knew that space, but you still have doubts, because you could have the best thing in the world and then you just don't know how to market it, and or you run out of money. There's a lot of things that could go wrong. You know, I mean, what was key was probably ending the juicer, because when something's failing, it is a time suck. So we had literally pulled the plug on it. And that's really hard to do. It just like, you know, somebody who's got a pet and they, you know, I've had friends who are like, they spend $10,000 on it to keep the dog alive. And you're like, you're just prolonging the inevitable. And also with the juicer, I'm like, am I prolonging the inevitable with this? And when you realize that, you got to be like, okay, my time, what little money we have left has to go over here to something that I really think has a future. And as much as I doubted myself, this is where I got smart about asking people around me. So I gave out like frying pans to some people I trusted who were pretty good cooks, home cooks. Then a couple of professionals. And they're like, this is pretty awesome. like, this is pretty cool. And I realized I never really heard that about the juicer from people. Like, it was much more passive, like, oh, nice. Oh, that looks cool. Juicing is a lot of work. Like,
yeah. But you were getting some indicators from the outside world that this was different.
Yeah. Yes. You know, the one challenge a little bit was that I did have to explain some stuff to people. So then you figure, like, how do you tell the story of why there are these hexagons on there? And what are the benefits? And why is it going to make your cooking experience so much richer if you were to use that product? And that was the fine-tuning period that happened in 16 into 17. Because, like, we, in 16, we sold our first pans in the fall of 16. It was moving, like, barely up each month into 17. And when we hit, like, mid-late 17, I was like, we have about 3 months worth of money. And that if it doesn't hit, you know, we're whether we like it or not, we're going to be out of business. And then November of 17, it started going. And and then it's been a rocket ship ever since.
Well, and before we wrap up, speaking of that rocket ship, I would be remiss not to bring up your partner, Gordon Ramsay, who is a huge talent and a huge star, but plays like a much more involved role than that in this company, right?
Absolutely.
What is the partnership like between the two of you, and how has it evolved over time?
He is a great guy. I work my ass off. I really do. I don't believe in days off, but that's just for me.
Your staff leaves at 5:30.
Yeah, I do. I leave too, and I'll take some time, but I work on Sundays. I work on Saturdays. It might only be 1 or 2 hours, but yeah. Gordon works harder than me. He's the hardest working guy I know. He's passionate about everything. And it was just strange, like, how it happened, you know, and it was so simple that, you know, he followed us on Instagram. Somebody had given him a pan. He liked it. We reached out. We said, can we send you more pans? They said, yes. By the way, does he have a deal with the cookware company? I don't think so. I'll check. And then cut to, we started a conversation. And the very first time I talked to Gordon, it's like full on pandemic time in the fall of 20. And we were already doing well. You know, we did between, I don't know, $57 and $60 million in revenue that year. So it was like a success at that point. Mm-hmm. And I had like 20 minutes scheduled for a call with Gordon. Gordon and I spent an hour and 20 minutes strategizing. We're like, he's like, I'm going to put these in my restaurant. And I can't do that. You know, something now and then I can do. He's like, mate, he goes, we're going to crush it. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. I'm going to put it on the TV shows. And we were just like two kids talking about it. And Gordon he'll come up like with an idea. You know, he'll be like, oh, I'm going to be in Vancouver. Why don't we do an event there? Well, because I'm there for another thing. I'm like, great. You tell me when to get there and we'll do a thing for influencers and press. He's smart. He's got an amazing business sense. And it's not like a studied one. He started a restaurant, his first restaurant. He made it a success. That restaurant is his flagship restaurant, still has 3 Michelin stars in London. And he still, when he's in London, he goes there and he works on recipes.
It's an insane
nurtures.
Feat.
Yeah, it's incredible. And it's strange. And like, I have a really good relationship with him. I mean, I can call him about anything. I don't need to call him about business. I could call him, you know, because, hey, I'm trying to navigate success in some way. And he's done it. He's been there. And he'll take the time. And he's one of the most loyal people. He helps everybody that comes into his life. If you were a chef for him 20 years ago, he's helped people in ways I probably can't talk about, but he's always there for people. So I can't speak more highly about the man.
But you know what? That is a testament to you as well. You know, if he's a man truly of like solid and decent character, it's like, of course he wasn't going to get involved in a company whose product he didn't deeply believe in. But it sounds like he also just like believed in you.
Well, I like the way you put that.
Yeah,
well, we get along well. And I think we both have similar sensibilities. And the fact is, life is short. So work hard, enjoy, you know, your blessings. You know, I'm like, I rarely like do this, pat myself on the back. Occasionally I will. I'm just grateful. Like, it's been so much fun the last 7 years, 8 years that, you know, I don't take any of it for granted. And I just feel, you know, the universe aligned in a way that I get to have a blast living my professional life.
What a gift. Thanks to my guest, Danny Weiner, co-founder and CEO of Hexclad. Be be sure to hit the subscribe button, like this, give us a comment so that you can stay up to date on future episodes. And thanks for watching. We'll see you next time.